Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren. Und ich bedanke mich immer, Herr Professor, ihn und dann besonders meine gute Freunde, Herr Professor Hans Herbert Gander, und der wir zusammen vor unseren Lehrer über 4,5 Jahre zusammengesessen und dann in, damals in Freiburg. Ich habe gesagt, Freiburg ist immer meine Lieblingsstadt. Und ich habe immer gesagt, habe ich da die beste meiner Neben in Freiburg gehabt. Und deswegen finde ich immer, mit meiner Frau kann man da wieder nach Freiburg. Und letzte Woche habe ich schon mein Thema über Liebe, der Begriff der Liebe in Chinesische Universität gesprochen und habe auch gesagt, dass heute mache ich Nebenliebe sicherlich, wenn wir über Sexualität sprechen. Aber ich wundere mich, dann letzte Woche, es gibt so viele Frauen, aber heute kommen nur einige. Sogar das gewissermaßen mehr nicht die jüngeren Leute, Menschen. Ja. Und, aber das macht nicht. Vielleicht interessiert sich wir Männer über Sex besonders. Aber wiederum, ich muss mich verzeihen, dass ich nicht so auf Deutsch sprechen kann. In den letzten so vielen Jahren habe ich viel Deutsch verlernt. Und hoffentlich, vielleicht in Zukunft kann ich auf Deutsch Vortrag halten kann. So I think I come back to English because I think I said that I find my German a little bit rusty. If I want to give a talk in German, then maybe it's difficult. So that maybe next time I'll speak in German. I hope my German come quite fast. Then maybe after 1 or 2 months I can speak better. So I think the night last week, I think some of you are already there. I started my this idea of why I'm interested in love and sex, because in the last week, before I left Freiburg for Hong Kong many years ago, I bought from the Wombach Book Handlung this set of books. And this is about sexuality and Liebe and art. And especially because of this book, then the last book about China. And China, one of the puzzle, of course, is one puzzle. Another puzzle is, of course, the love. But this particular painting is because, this couple are making love. But the interesting thing is that why a child is allowed to sit in front of this pair. Maybe they are their parents. But to allow a child to be in a so-called pornographic painting is quite unusual. So at that time, I'm always thinking, why did this happen? Why is this only a unique one? Or whether there's other painting? And also how to compare with other erotic painting in other cultures? So in the last 20 years, I have searched for many books, and then of course I have found out some other interesting painting, and look at the other one. So this one, is interesting, and I know this the cover of the book. This is claimed that is by the a very famous Bing painter called Shou Ying. Probably it's fake, it's not true. But looking at the painting, we know that it's a painting about the late Ming Dynasty. Or the other one, it should be in Qing Dynasty. But I of course also find other similar painting. Then you look at the hairstyle is also kind of a Ming Dynasty, the folk painting. And you look at the way they said, of course, there's some so-called pornographic pictures. I think you allow me to show this, you of this explicit sexuality thing. But one thing I hope you to look at, first of all, how the people interact, and also and look at the penis size. This is very important because when you compare it with later with another the comparative the painting with the Japanese, you'll find a totally different world. So this then this coming kind of interesting thing that the child is getting away from the woman, perhaps his mother. But the thing is, why did this happen? Or does he always show this? So this also interesting is that they are already doing this sexual intercourse, but behind there's a child coming. And one thing about the Chinese pornographic so-called painting, first of all, as far as the physiology is concerned, that's not true to the human body. The Chinese painter never do an exactly kind of comparative to the Renaissance painter in the West, and their anatomy is poor. Look at the legs. But the important thing is that how the facial expression. Most of the so-called pornographic painting that I've ever seen about Chinese pornography is that the most people, they when they are engaging in a sexual act, apparently they look pleasant. They are enjoying themselves, and especially look at this during the sex act and the child behind her, and like this. They are the joyful, playful. And it's also the one thing they're doing this, and then the child is saying hello. There's some of the five pictures. Then, there's one last thing is that it's an old man, perhaps it's a grandchildren, but doesn't matter. But of course, my problem is that why the Chinese painter let children appear in this kind of painting? When you go to other things, of course, when you look at these pictures, you know that is one of the most important kind of a characteristic of represent Chinese sexual act is that yun yu. Yun is clouds, yu is rain. And this is like symbolic. We, in Chinese the literature, we never say make love. Make love is totally a modern contemporary way of saying that is the intercourse. So the sexual intercourse is also a very much scientific term. But in the Chinese way, yun yu, just clouds and wind and rain. And this kind of said they have just ended their sexual act. And so-called, the rain stopped and the cloud dispersed. So that means that they have finished that. But look at their kind of facial expression. They look each other, they're satisfied. The kind of, they have done a pleasant work, and then they're enjoying each other. And of course, the anatomy is not that particularly good, but the facial expression is different. Something like this kind of sex act. It's also a kind of showing that enjoying this act. But look at that, as I compare to the Japanese. The Japan, most of the kind, this kind of work is, first of all, they are all like raping. The woman is a submissive one. They always turn down the nun. And they, one of the things they say is just that the kind of exaggeration of the penis size. Of course, it's because of the Japanese idea of sexuality of the men, male chauvinistic, powerful thing. So they emphasize on the unbelievable, impossible size. But the size of the penis means that they are kind of power. Them. So all the women are sort of submissive to this kind of act. When look at this, it's all like this. And a lot of this kind of so-called S&M, and that's a sadistic kind of act motive, you can find a lot of in the Japanese painting, as well as when you look at the so-called the pornographic film, so even nowadays, this kind of S&M, the sadistic masochistic act, is very frequent in the Japanese thing. But it's very rare in Chinese. So they come to my text, all the paintings, because originally that I have not that many photos, but Professor Yin asked me to get more pictures, that is for you to understand just visually, the kind of different that compared with the Chinese and the other culture. So I think I saw my reading and hopefully more slowly. Foucault, in his first writing about sexual sexuality, suggests that the ars erotica is the Chinese way to see sexuality, whereas in the Western tradition is a sentient sexualis. Indeed, similar to love, there is no Chinese philosophy of sexuality. However, the Chinese understanding of human sexuality begins at the metaphysics of I Ching. Through the influence of the religious Taoism, not to confuse with Taoism as the philosophy of Laozi and Zhuangzi, and the back chamber manuals, sexuality has a different meaning compared to the West. In this lecture, I shall try to illustrate the meaning of sexuality in this Chinese context through a study of a law for late called Cipo Zizhuan in the late Ming Dynasty. Get the introduction of the study, the academic study of Chinese sexuality. This series of academic research on Chinese sexuality in the modern times only began with the publication of two books by the Dutch sinologist Robert van Coolidge. The one is in 1951, it's an erotic color print of the Ming Dynasty, 1951. And also in the 1961, in the sexual life in ancient China. This has become the very definitive for the modern study of Chinese sexuality. So this is the Chinese translation by one of the very famous, very important scholar in Beijing University, Li Ning. So let me talk about this man, because I always have great respect and then admire this man, Robert van Coolidge. Robert van Coolidge, this man, look at this, said, he is not an academic sinologist. He indeed is a professional diplomat. Before he died in 1967, he was the ambassador of Holland in Japan. But interesting is that the writing of this Dutch diplomat and author Robert van Coolidge, 1910 and to 1967, and too bad indeed he died very young, reveal his considerable talents as a storyteller, as well as a conscientious scholarship and very interest that characterized his life. His nonfiction work cover a broad range of subjects from the Chinese culture, folklore, art and music, such as the Chinese pictorial art as viewed by the connoisseur, and erotic color paintings of the Ming period and the Gibbon on China. Van Coolidge also translated works from Sanskrit and Chinese, was co-author with vocabulary of the Sixic language and of the Blackfoot Indian, and wrote a study of the horse cult in China and Japan. You look at this man, he's an unbelievable man. When he was young, he already knew 13 languages, even though he's a Dutch. And of course, Latin and Chinese, and then Sanskrit, Indian, Japanese. And he's also widely known for the detective fiction. Most of us know him through this fiction. It's called the Di Gong An, three murder cases solved by the Judge Di, which led him to write a series of 17 books featuring the Chinese magistrate Judge Di, from the Chinese maze murder to murder in Canton, and the posthumously published Poet and Murder. So when we go to the book Hanlong, when look after from Van Coolidge, it's still a series of creamy of thrills by the so-called the Judge Di books are still very much in sale. Both people still remember his creamy writer. But of course, for me, he's known better than this. As a diplomat whose career spanned four decades, Van Coolidge served the Pope in posts around the world, and his publication history reflects his act. He wrote in Chinese, Dutch, English, Italian, and Japanese. In addition, the volume issued by the European commercials and scholarly publishers, his books appeared under the imprint of publishing houses in Japan, China, Malaysia, India, and Lebanon.
Van Gulik also prepared several important works for private distribution in very limited edition. So in fact, I wonder how he can manage to do all the research, because he is by profession, he's a diplomat. He has to work and later become the main consul as a major diplomat for representing his country. But when you look at his work, he's a man that he does not go to the so-called big theory. He goes my very minor one. For example, when his last work called The Gibbon of China, Gibbon is monkey, they said. He used to reading over the Chinese poetry and talk about so many words, places that mention about monkeys. So go into research and think why the monkey is so interesting in China. They don't understand it. And in fact, I read his book, and most of the reasonable, he write by hand. He can write Chinese. His calligraphy is very good. He can play guqin and also craft seals and can compose and make poetize in Chinese. It's an amazing man, but he died so early. So of course, this is just my introduction. Of course, Douglas Wallace in his book of Chinese Sexual Yoga writes assess the contribution of these two works, which stand to this day as the only book-length scholarly monograph on sexual custom, erotic arts and literature, and esoteric sexual practices in China. They have the further distinction of being virtually the sole source of second-hand studies and the translation. Van Gulik was indeed a fervent and extremely serious sinologist whose interest in Chinese sexuality was originally on the sign issue. His purpose in those two books is to dispel the ignorance of both the Westerner and the Chinese world regarding the nature of Chinese sexuality. This is one of his comments in this introduction. He said, an examination of material thus assembled convinced me that the current foreign conception of deprived and abnormal sexual habits of the ancient Chinese was completely wrong. It might be expected of a highly cultured and thoughtful people like the Chinese. They did indeed, since early times, give a great deal of attention to sex matters. One of the main arguments of the present publication is to refute such arbitrary allegation and to show that until the 13th century, the separation of the sexes was not strictly enforced and sexual relations freely talked and written about. For these ancient Chinese had indeed no reason for hiding their sexual life. The handbook of sex proved clearly that the sexual habits were healthy and normal, at any rate by the norms of the polygamy system that had prevailed in China from the oldest known time till recent years. That was the quotation from his work on the sexual life in ancient China, that come to my comment. Van Gogh's major argument of Chinese sexual naturalism are to a large extent based on the analysis of his rediscovery of his hitherto unnoticed writing on the art of the bed chambers, who were apparently long forgotten in China, but were preserved in Japan. From his translation, interpretation, and discussion of the original text, a new paradigm of research in Chinese sexology has emerged. The fundamental texts are the Handbook of Sex, that is, the art of the bed chambers, and the subject matter are Taoism, the yin-yang theory, sexual machines, sexual medicine, sexual practices, and sexual psychology. This paradigm set the research direction on Chinese sexuality in the last 30 years. It is obvious that the sexual ideas and practices in all these handbooks of sex are the integral part of Chinese culture. But this is, however, certainly an exaggeration to identify the content of the handbooks of sex with Chinese sexuality per se. The yin-yang theory, which is a basic presupposition of Chinese sexology, emphasizes the reciprocity and harmony between the two sexes. It assumes the mutual equal status between male and female at the cosmological level, of which sexual intercourse is only an instant. However, it's not the case when sexuality is seen outside the bed chambers, in a real everyday life situation. The dominant Confucian patriarchal society falls short of a real equal and liberal sexualism, whereas women suffer, liberal view of sexuality. Traditional Chinese men have all the benefit of sexual naturalism, whereas women suffer from it. Hence, a more comprehensive understanding of Chinese sexuality should not be limited to the sole study of the handbooks of sex. They are indeed very interesting because they surpass Ovid's Ars Amatoria, the Indian Kama Sutra, and even the modern The Joy of Sex, as far as the quantity of the literature, medical knowledge, variety of sexual techniques, philosophical content and insight, as well as detailed psychological observation are concerned. In fact, there have been enough publication cashing in the secrets of Chinese sexuality since Van Gogh's book. Nevertheless, materials other than this handbook should not be neglected. Van Gogh admitted in the preface of Sexual Life in Ancient China that he came upon the subject of ancient Chinese sexual life by accident, and his qualifications for writing about it are limited to those of an Orientalist with a general interest in anthropology. In short, he considered himself not as a sexologist, but a sinologist in a more classical sense. That is, his interests are more in literature, art and culture in a broad sense. Indeed, his insightful examination on Chinese sexuality in painting and literary writings, other than in the handbook of sex, had not generated much study and research in this direction. So the purpose of this paper is to look at the Chinese traditional sexuality from literary study. Because there is no philosophy of sexuality in China. We look at all the philosophical corpus of Chinese, whether in Confucianism, in Taoism, or Buddhism, as far as the major texts is concerned, we find nothing. So I come to tackle on this problem not from the philosophical side, but from a little booklet called from the genre of so-called Yanjing novel. This called, in fact, Yanjing is a more pithy way to say this, pornographic, but because pornography have different sense in the Chinese way, which belong to the same time to the category of the banned book. This paper takes one leaflet in the Ming Dynasty, Qi Po Zi Zhuan, literally, the study of an indulgent woman, as an outstanding example of the tension between sexuality and morality. This story contained explicit sexual description, which was therefore later banned by both the Ming and Qing time. According to Van Gogh, it was extant in Imperial China, but was preserved in a monastery in Kyoto, Japan. The importance of this much neglected and forgotten pornographic novelet is not only because of the particular literary style, that is, autobiographical memoir of a woman, which was more uncommon in Chinese literature, but also in its description of the struggle for sexual autonomy by the hero, thus disclosing the sharp inequality between the two genders. Under traditional patriarchal culture, women were objects of exploitation, despite the apparent philosophical emphasis on the harmony in both Confucianism and Taoism, as well as the theory of reciprocity and equality implicit in the cosmology of sex. On the other hand, the sympathetic attitude of the author, this story, towards the heroine was most unusual when compared to other contemporary law forms in the same genre. It is perhaps in certain sense, this is my assertion, in certain sense the first feminist law form ever written in Chinese. Psychological description of female sexual experience from adolescent to mature womanhood are given through rich details and telling observation, unprecedented in Chinese literature, even in later pornographic novels, despite depicting female sexuality. Furthermore, it's the example of a book, though pornographic in nature, with an influence by the rebellious spirit and critique of the dominant morality by some enlightened intellectual at that particular time. The importance of this short story, however, though in many respects a unique one, must not be overstated, of course, because after all, Traditional Chinese novel did not enter into the main intellectual stream of the learned class. Sexuality as well as the erotic love were never the topic discussed by Chinese philosophers. This novel was but a tiny protest against the prevailing conservatism of the day. So my interest in this story is therefore not from a purely literary point of view, but from the broader historical context of the idea. Because the story has brought forth a number of questions concerning sexuality and morality against the background of Chinese philosophical tradition. The analysis of this story will serve as a starting point to look into the cosmological and ethical dimension of female sexuality in the context of the Chinese patriarchal tradition. At the same time, I would like to examine the intellectual background of the rebellious intent of this story. I talk a little bit about the banned book. Freedom of expression and publication had never been a tradition in China. Ever since the Chinese Qing Dynasty, the dynasty before the Han Dynasty, literary writing was censored and banned, mostly because of political reason rather than moral or religious ground. Books are banned in most cases when the content was explicitly or implicitly in conflict with the contemporary ruling ideology, and sometimes simply because they were to be to the disfavor of the emperor or those in power. Of course, up to present time, it's still the case, I'm sorry to say. The worst time was the Qing Dynasty, where numerous books of diverse content were banned and the author executed. Philosophical writing and historical interpretation outside the official line were among the first to be banned, together with many literary writing like poetry and novels, even though the subject matter may be totally innocent and entertaining. Erotic books were, of course, not allowed to circulate. Erotic novels, rather than the Yinqing novels, were in their heyday in the second half of the Ming Dynasty. They may be classified as pornographic literature because all these novels involve explicit description of sexual act. The famous novel of the naming period, for example, the Golden Lotus, Jin Ping Mei, and the kind of prayer met Yu Pu Chuan. The Yu Pu Chuan was also translated in German, I think this the last century, belong to this genre. Though the authorship of a novel in question, Qi Po Ji Chuan, is unclear, as anonymity were the usual practice of this genre of stories. The dates of publication, however, should be well before the Yu Pu Chuan in mid-16th century. This book should also have enjoyed a relatively good readership and should be circulated well beyond the publication date. It can be considered as one of the earliest erotic novels in China. The name of this novel is comparatively short, as it contained only two books or chapters. It was written in classical, concise, classical literary style, the Wen Yan. Hence, the language is compact and concise as contrast to the vernacular stories in oral style, Bai Wa. One significant feature of this novel is the format of an autobiographical account by the heroine, which may be the first of its kind in all Chinese novels. Feng Guli rendered the Chinese title of Qi Po Ji Chuan, Biography of a Foolish Woman. This translation of Qi into foolish misses completely the original meaning, which is more than a connotation of stupidity or foolishness, but a kind of obsession in indulgence. The frequent association of the word Qi with Qing, hence Qing Qi, means a passionate indulgence of love. Incidentally, the alleged editor of this novel is called Qing Qiji. In the short preface to the novel of the meaning of the indulgence, Qi is explained in relation to the three important ideas of Qing: amorous affection, Xing, human nature or essence, and Xin, mind in a philosophical manner. It stated, I quote, "It is always the case that the movement of human nature, Xing, is amorous affection, Qing. The manifestation of human nature is amorous affection, whereas amorous affection comes out from human nature. At the same time, human nature is actualized in the mind. Sin. When the mind is not upright, then it becomes deviated. If it is deviated, then it's uncontrollable. If the amorous affection comes out freely from the whatever the mind desire, then the result is hardly not indulgence. So we shall discuss this translation, this discussion on the relation between these three important concepts later, because this will link up with the philosophical problem of sexuality and morality. So now, look at the story. The stories are very simple, interesting, but if you know Chinese, but of course in classical Chinese, you can read it in less than 3 hours. So the story is interesting. The story of Qipao Zhizhuan is told from the first person point of view, in the form of a manhua told to a young traveler by a 70-year-old woman, Anna. The heroine of the story was born to a scholarly family. She first developed her sexual awareness at around 12 and was then initiated about the meaning of sex and the naturalism of sexual intercourse by female neighbor, who gave her detailed description of the pain and joy of sexual acts. Seducing her cousin to be her first sex partner, Anna tried out his sexual fantasy. But the losing of the virginity together was not a very happy experience. The cousin, who then began to enjoy sex with Anna after several attempts, was separated by Anna by her mother. The son of a servant became Anna's next lover, who gave her much enjoyable sexual experience. At the age of 17, Anna was married to the second son of a Confucian scholar of noble descent. Having successfully put on act as if she was still a virgin, Anna won her husband's praise on the day following the wedding night, that she was indeed a well-educated lady and with good propriety. After a year, her husband left home for his study. Anna, feeling lonely, seduced the servant of her oldest brother-in-law, and they happily indulged in sex. One day, while having intercourse, they were caught by another servant, who threatened to tell others if Anna did not have sex with him. Reluctantly, she did. As she returned to her room, hastily she ran into her older brother-in-law and he raped her. One day she accidentally discovered the affair between her father-in-law and the wife of his older brother-in-law. They dragged him into the sex game and she was raped by the old man, who unashamedly claimed that the wife of her sons were also his. From then on, she continued her sexual relations with all these men. Subsequently, the younger brother-in-law, an actor, a monk, and his master all became her sexual partners. Altogether, she had sexual relations with 13 different men. In between, she had a son, but did not know who the father was. Her affair with this man came to a change when she met and fell in love with the tutor of her now grown-up son. She soon gave herself exclusively to him while ignoring all other men who, jealous and angry, report to Anna's new affairs to her husband. Her husband, being kept in ignorance for all these years, was so angry that he threatened to kill her immediately. Eventually, she was saved with her son's pleading and was banished out of the family forever. She was then 39. So until the age of 70, when Anna retold the story to the young traveler, Anna had lived a life of remorse for her previous deeds. Several questions can be asked of this story. First, is it a purely pornographic novel aiming at exciting the lust of the reader? What is the significance of sex in this story? Secondly, who are the readers? And there are other vernacular stories for populace in the same period. This story was written in classical literary style, which implies that it was meant for the literary. Third, why did the author employ the style of manhua of a woman? Autobiography was a strand of Chinese literature, especially used in novel writing, was already very rare. The first-person account of a woman, even more remarkable. Was it meant for an educated female readership? Fourthly, Anna was brought up in an educated family and she was later married to a Confucian scholar, Gentry family. According to the legal practice at that time, She has committed indeed very serious crimes, adultery, and most serious of all, incest. All these crimes should lead to capital punishment. However, the author just let her be banished from her family and even live up to an advanced age of 70. What is the moral reason of this story? And why was the author so lenient to his heroine? The answer to this question will open to a re-examination of the ideas of sexuality in Chinese culture. The theoretical foundation of sexuality of Chinese culture was laid in the Book of Change, the I Ching. From this foundation come into two different developments, the sexual naturalism embodied in the Taoistic conception as presented in the handbooks of sex, and the subsumption of sexuality under the Confucian moral system, a system which accounts for the kinship structure and gender differentiation. Both development implies an objectification of women. In sexual naturalism, the taking of women as an instrument by which men achieve longevity. And in Confucianism, the taking of women as a means by which men maintain a family structure. As far as Chinese sexual culture is concerned, women was an object of exploitation and suppression. The female gender was in the final analysis reduced to only to two roles, a moral agent for maintaining the order of kinship, ren ren, and a playmate for obtaining sexual pleasure, ren yu. There's a cultural background in which Qi Po Ji Chuan was written, against which background Anna, though her tragic fate was obvious from the very start, tried to rebel. When you compare this, of course, once a similar book is called Fanny Hill, Qi Po Ji Chuan, presented as a memoir of the sexual history of a Chinese woman, preceded by at least 200 years. The nearest counterexample from Western pornography, John Kirtland's Fanny Hill, the memoir of a woman of pleasure, 1748. I said the Qi Po Ji Chuan should be in the middle of the 16th century. So two centuries before. Qi Po Ji Chuan might well be the one of the first novel of this kind in world literature. The erotic description was extremely vivid and are given with great psychological insight. In particular, Anna's physical reaction and also emotional experience during her first sexual encounter with her cousin was described in elaborate detail. So how it feel painful in the beginning and gradually how it become pleasurable and all in very telling details. The story contained also an array of all possible positions and techniques of sexual intercourse. You know, look at the sexual manual, of course, they say that all in Dong Yuanzi, there are the 36 positions of sexual act. So you can nearly see all these acts described in this book. So definitely, that's very pornographic in a sense. That the story contained into the array of all possible positions and techniques of sexual intercourse from above, from behind, from every possible position. Though it is not possible to identify the true authorship and the gender of the author, the sensibility of Anna's sexual experience showed that if the author was not a woman, he must at least have been a great sympathizer of women. The shock presented by the publication of Fanny Hill in 18th century England was due to unashamed hedonism, vivid elaboration and celebration of sexual pleasure, all of which were in direct confrontation with the predominant Christian attitude towards sex. The negative approach to sex, associating sex with original sin, was a major cause of sexual repression during the period. By all means, it was the intention of John Kirtland to write an erotic pornographic novel for the entertainment of and consumption by female readers, by male readers, I'm sorry. The use of first-person point of view through the eyes of the women or the female protagonist Fanny Hill is obviously not a genuine feminist point of view, but it's rather a result of male sexual fantasy projected onto a male on a female character. Female sexuality then becomes inviting for enjoyment by men without feeling of guilt or sin. The open endorsement of sexual pleasure was of course not in line with the moral values laid down by the Christian Church. This is why the Bishop of London at that time denounced the book as an open insult upon religion and good manner, and a reproach to the honor of the government and the law of the country. Fanny Hill, therefore, is pornographic in the sense that its description of sexual act is meant to serve no other purpose than excite sexual fantasy to the reader. Obviously, the same intent was generally held by writers of Chinese pornographic stories in the Ming and Qing periods. Novel like an official record of the embroidered church culture, before 1600, or an official history of the bamboo garden, also before 1610, are a good example of what Van Gogh calls undiluted pornography. Among these novels, the most important and famous is, of course, the Carnal Prayer Mat, of which the authorship allegedly subscribed to Li Yu, the origin and great literary writer of the late dynasty. The preface of this novel said Patrick Hanan, who translated the novel into English, regards the novel as a solitary classic of Chinese pornography, and further considered it as outdoing all other novels of the same genre with description of the relentlessly quantification of sex. Its fascination with women's sexuality, its emphasis on penis size, its account of the animal penis implant and the sexual orgies. Indeed, the exaltation of libertinism in the opening chapter may be a kind of manifesto for pornography and also for sexual promiscuity. He said, there's not a single worthy thing of the existence of man as he is driven into never-ending toil and wearing of daily life. It is therefore a great blessing for us that in the beginning of the universe, the sage institute sexual love between male and female, so that our suffering and worries can be relieved through this activity. According to our egghead Confucian scholars, they alone below the ways of the woman are the opening from which we are born and in which we die. However, from the view of the enlightened, if we are the one of these things of the woman in our life, our hair may turn white to a few years sooner and our life may be shortened substantially. So we should therefore understand that women can be treated as medicine, which to be used neither too sparsely nor too frequently, and which is neither to be avoided nor to be excessively indulged in. Before we engage in sex with women, we should think that they are medicine and not poison. So why should we have any fear? But when we engage in sex, we should remind ourselves that this is medicine and not food, so we will not indulge in it. So doing, the yin and yang will mutually reinforce each other. Is it not of great benefit to men? After expounding this positive meaning of libertinism, the author did not forget to add a statement of the moral justification of writing erotic novels. The whole purpose, according to the author, is to demonstrate the meaning of retribution for one who is excessively indulged in sex and who seduces the wife of other men. There is no use, say the author, in writing a moral treatise showing all the evils of sex because nobody likes to listen to a sermon. However, the warning of excessive sex should be implicitly infused in this erotic text, the author go on to say. It's better to use exactly erotic activities to persuade the reader of the evil. When he is very absorbed in reading the story, then a few notes of warning should be added at an unexpected place, so that the reader should say to himself with a sigh, if having excessive sex with women should lead to such evil, it's important to save my own body for more future enjoyment rather than to die as the ghost of the peony flower. It is more meaningful to do concrete business rather than to waste one's energy on empty deeds. However, such moral lecture on retribution and sexual evil does not diminish the fact that Ru Bo Quan is indeed a pornographic novel. If we cut away all the sex scenes in the novel, there's not much left to read. Here is a distinction between Rupochuan and Jin Pingmei. In this sense, despite the elaborate description, it's not the sole theme. At the end of Rupochuan, our hero, after enjoying numerous beautiful women, came to a sudden enlightenment. He realized finally the emptiness of sexual excess and the meaning of retribution. He left the mundane world and became a Taoist master. The reader is left to wonder whether the hero received any actual punishment or had any genuine remorse for all the women whom he had seduced. Among all Chinese pornographic novels written in the period of Ming and Qing dynasty, have a moralistic statement as a cover, but it does not really matter as long as the theory and story is erotic and entertaining, and at the same time, sexual lust is being excited. Let us turn back to our love for it in Qipo Jizhuan. Is Yishu Qipo Jizhuan pornography? The answer is surely affirmative if we consider the abundant description of sexual act when viewed in a large number of pages in the love for it. Without sex, there's little left in the novel. However, it's exactly the theme of the feminine sexuality as presented in the law books that is to be questioned. For a particular law for it, the question how and why sex is so presented and interpreted is surely more important than the question whether or not the book is pornographic. Although the autobiographical representation of Qipo Jizhuan is unique, there was in the Chinese tradition no shortage of erotic novel featuring women as the hero. The most famous one of the Ming and Qing dynasty are the story of the pleasing gentleman, the Yu Yiguan Zhenzhen, an official history of the bamboo garden, and the fascinating story of Zhao Xiaoyang. It's all in the century. The first of these titles are about the exorbitant sex life of Empress Wu. Wu Zhetian, the only female empress in the Tang Dynasty. The other two have sexual vampirism as the theme, and are stories about the beautiful women preying on men. All three purport to have historical reference, of which the heroines were real figures in history. Nevertheless, it's hardly the intention of the three author or the above-mentioned novel to mean the books as historical stories. The major interest in each of these three books lies, of course, in the colorful details and variation of the sexual activities in which certain lustful women and their men engage. However, in each case, negative judgments are unmistakably imposed on the hearing. For a Chinese emperor, it was a common and unquestionable practice to possess a great number of concubines and women. Sexual enjoyment on the part of the life of the emperor. Empress Wu, notwithstanding being the powerful as any other Chinese emperor, was traditionally condemned as immoral and having a handful of male sexual partners. Her usurpation of the Tang throne was considered politically and morally wrong, and one of the reasons of her evil character was her never satiable sexual lust. Such negative view against Empress Wu is implicit in Yu Yiguan Zhenzhen. The hearing of the other two novels, Zhi Lan Ye Shi and Zhao Yang Zhe Shi, was in fact vixen turned women coming down from the mountains to prey on men for achieving immortality by absorption of the male's essence during the intercourse. Women in the final analysis were evil and dangerous. Compared with this story, Qipo Jizhuan is different, not in the erotic content, which are as explicit and pornographic as the others, but in the language and the psychological insight embedded in the narration. As noted above, the Love of Light has a few outstanding features. The first account by Anna of her development from sexual curiosity to maturity and finally to expertise in act. The detailed psychological and emotional description of feminine sexual experiences and the use of elegant classical literary languages. All these features make this novel unique in Chinese literature. No other Chinese novel surpass Qipo Jizhuan as far as these features are concerned. Anna's libertinism was a gradual process. The sexual instruction given to the adolescent Anna by female neighbors was a rare piece of realistic and educational statement of human sexuality. It began with the concept of sexuality in terms of yin-yang cosmology, stressing that naturally some all sexual activity. Then it was followed by a physiological explanation of the differences between male and female sex organs. Finally, it was a precise psychological description of the feeling during the first sexual intercourse. It hurt subtly in the beginning and no joy it felt. Then it gradually developed into a joyous feeling and ultimately to ecstasy beyond the expression of words. It's so written in the novel. So upon this instruction began our sexual adventure. What's unusual about the introduction to the meaning of sex is certainly not just the idea of sexual cosmology, which is quite common for other erotic novels as a naturalistic justification of sexual promiscuity, but the positive and active attitude of female sexuality as assertion of women's right to enjoy sex. Such view is, in fact, quite consistent with the more ancient idea of sexuality. Chinese sexual naturalism has a fundamental root in yin-yang. Human sexual relations are seen against a cosmic background of changes due to the interplay or duality of yin and yang, the heaven and hell and earth, and the feminine and the masculine. The successive movement of yin-yang constitute the way, in this theory, reciprocity and complementarity of the two genders are emphasized, and hence the equality between the two sexes is maintained. When the religious Taoism developed this idea into sexual theory of the bed chambers, the importance of this reciprocity is preserved. Joseph Newton rightly observed this. Joseph Newton, of course, who writes these many volumes concerning the science and civilization in China in the last century, also refute the idea that there is no science and technology in China. His contribution to sort of refute this idea, saying that China before the 17th century was the science and technologies were above of all other Western achievement. So he said the recognition of the importance of women in the schema of things, the acceptance of equality of women with men, the conviction that the attainment of health and longevity lead the cooperation of the sexes, to consider admiration for certain feminine psychological characteristics, the incorporation of the physical phenomena of sex in numerous group catharsis, free alike from asceticism and class distinction, reveal to us one more expert Taoism with no counterpart in Confucianism or ordinary Buddhism. Such an idea are indeed reflected in the fundamental principle of the Handbook of Sex. The opening chapter of one of the important handbook, The Master of the Cave Profound, Dong Yuanji said, of the myriad things begotten by heaven, men alone is the most precious. The place of man's being esteemed is in its moderation and sexual desire. He models heaven, immutates the earth, adjust to the female element, and conform to the male element. Those who realize this principle cultivated their nature and prolonged their life, their years. Those who are contemptuous of this truth induce the spirit and prematurely shorten their years. However, one must not be mistaken that the sexual naturalism with the apparent emphasis on sexual equality was a fundamental principle governing the sexual human relation outside sexual practice. The idea of womanhood is expounded by Ban Qiu of the late Han Dynasty in the woman's precepts has determined the submissive role of the woman in traditional Chinese culture. The education of women along Ban to understand the Confucianism ought to be aimed exclusively at teaching women her inferiority to men and inculcate in her absolute obedience to the husband. Hence, the idea of sexual equality was only a hypocritical pretext of exploitation of women by men. The significance of Qi Po Ji Zhuan can be considered as a critique of the Chinese traditional Chinese Confucianism morality by female sexuality. If Anna's sexual promiscuity is a greater sin, It is even the greatest sin to be sexually incestuous with a father-in-law and brother-in-law. However, the author writes with a sympathetic attitude towards Anna. He writes with great disgust the raping of Anna by her in-laws, remembering that all these men were well-established Confucian scholars. The author apparently approved the sexual naturalism and encouraged Anna to exercise her sexual right and choice. Traditionally, the sexual right was exercised with no problem at all by any Chinese man because he was allowed to be promiscuous on condition that he did not violate the moral order of the family. Woman, however, had no such right, and for this reason, Anna was condemned. Anna, being the victim of sexual exploitation, was a doomed tragic heroine who tried to assert her own sexual autonomy. On the other hand, among her sexual partners, not a single man suffered from any condemnation with the exception of the tutor with whom Anna fell in love. This tutor deserved to be punished simply because he assumed the exclusive sexual assets to Anna by exposing the hypocrisy of Confucian family. The story of Anna is a tragic rebellion against the dominant patriarchal sexual ideology in traditional China. Thank you.